Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Percussion Loft, the podcast from Gonbops, the leading percussion instrument manufacturer since 1954. I'm Rich Mangiacaro. So glad you could join us as we hear from the world's greatest drummers and percussionists. Let's get started. My guest today is the amazing Cuban percussionist Eliel Lazo. I was initially introduced to him by another great Cuban drummer, Raul Pineda, and seeing him play that first time, I was struck by his effortless technique and wonderful sound that he got from the congas. Right away, I knew I was easily seeing one of the great congueros in the world today. Eliel has played with a host of greats, including Michel Camilo, Chucho Valdez, Diane Reeves, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, the list goes on. His solo releases, some of which you'll be hearing today, border between 70s funk and Cuban songo, with a whole lot of soul mixed in. Eliel, are there other musicians in your family?
Not really. I am officially the first musician in my family, and then my brother, actually, my younger brother, he's also a musician. But my grandfather, he wanted to have a band, actually. And him and my grandma went in to have 9 children in order to try to make the band.
Really?
Yeah. So some of my father and some of my uncles, they went to music school. But because of the passing of my grandfather at early age, they couldn't continue. So they didn't succeed to become musicians like my grandfather would have liked. So I feel lucky to be the one that kind of became a musician later.
Was it a brother that was also a musician though?
Yeah, my younger brother is a musician. Actually, he started studying music before I did. But for some reason he stopped taking piano lessons, and then I kind of start playing percussion and went into music school and everything. And then after many years of me playing music, and my brother, he graduated as an architect, he started kind of like being interested again in writing songs and playing music. And one time I just went back to Cuba and he already was studying with Oscar Valdez, my teacher. And out of the blue, he was already playing in the band Diagara, where I started playing music professionally. So it was like, wow, man. And now he lives also here in Denmark and we play together.
He's a piano player?
No, he's a percussionist and singer.
Is he older or younger?
1 year younger.
Okay. You know, tell me about the Oscar Valdez percussion school that you went to.
Oh, man, well, it was such an honor to be an Oscar's student. And, you know, I have to thank him so many times. It's like, he took so much time. He dedicated so much time for me. He put so much of his time out for me. And he didn't charge 1 cent. You know, not even 1 cent. I was a student for at least 2.5 years, maybe 3 years. And after that, I became the percussionist of his band, Diacara, at that time. We are talking about 1997, 98. And I was in his band for like 3 years or something like that. And still at that time, I was still his student. We would go and do some lessons and stuff. And well, his way of teaching, his school of percussion is very popular. It's very popular. He has a lot of students from different places in the world, and he have a lot of Cuban students too. You know, it's the old school way of teaching, you know, a little bit more rustic way, but you actually get to learn a lot, you know. I have nothing by love to Oscar, and you know, I have nothing by appreciation, you know, I'm so thankful for all the time he dedicated to me, man, and it's been a blessing.
Was he kind of your first main influence, would you say?
Not really. I think the first time I kind of got, you know, I remember, I think in the beginning of the 90s, mid-90s, there was this video called Pasaporte with Tatawine and Anga. And it's a video which a friend of mine sent, a friend of mine found it and sent it to me not too long ago. It's a video where Tatawine and Anga are playing in a solar. Solar is one of those places where people live very close to each other in the middle of town. It's kind of like, I don't know how you would call it, like a ghetto or something like that. You know, it's a lot of poor people in not the best conditions. They live there together, no? But anyways, Tatawine and Anga are playing in that place during that video called Pasaporte. And I remember me as a, let's say I might have been 9, 10 years old or something like that. I saw that video and I was like, wow, that's what I want to be. I want to be like these guys. I want to play like that, you know? So I might say that Tatawine and Anga were my really first kind of, you know? And then from there, I got to know about many others. I had this neighbor that he used to play very loud, Irakere, right beside where I live. And I was like, who are these guys? Oh, this is Irakere. And the one that played the congas, they call him El Niño. And I was like, wow, I also want to play I want to play in that type of band. I want to be, you know, like those musicians out there, you know? So yeah, you know, Tatawine, Anga, and then El Niño. And then my father, he saw my interest for percussion. And he said to me, are you sure you want to do this? Are you really serious about it? Because if you're really serious, I'm going to take you right now to Oscar Valdez. Oscar Valdez lives maybe like 10 blocks from where I live, you know. So I said to him, yes, I want to. So we worked there and met Oscar, and my father told him, look, this is my son. He want to be a percussionist. Can you help him? He said to me, can I see your hands? He say, okay, yeah, I think I can. I think he have some good hands. Let's work with him and see what happened. And that's how everything started, you know.
And your style on playing congas is just seems effortless, and it's so smooth the way you play. You get so much sound, and your ability to use the efficiency of your movements and on all of that. Now, did this come naturally to you when you were younger? I mean, or did you develop it from watching these people that influenced you, or how did that come? Because I mean, seriously, you know, watching you play and watching other congueros play, I mean, it's definitely, you definitely make it look very easy. So, I mean, did it come naturally to you in the early days?
Well, I think what really happened, it was that I start to kind of I don't think it came like that natural. Let's start from there. I think it was also like a vision I had of like, okay, if I practice this type of movements and try to relax, let's see what happened. You know, I used to practice in front of a mirror, and I used to kind of try to find different ways, like how do I do this and look still relaxed? How do I that? And kind of, you know, I love to work also with the body language, you know, when I play. So I don't think it's like that natural. I think right now it's more natural, but started as a kind of like experiment, I might say. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's interesting that you used a mirror and you were watching movements because, you know, as you know, I mean, watching when certain teachers will have you do that, you know, when you're practicing, you know, use a mirror, watch your hands, you know, get the uniformity, you know, of your hands. And
yeah, I might say for me, it was extremely important to have that possibility to practice in front of a mirror. It made a huge change in my technique, in my posture, in, you know, everything, my expression. Sometimes you start playing for a long time and then you don't realize about a lot of things you are doing. And then once you sit in front of a mirror, you say, oh, I'm doing this, my elbow is too high, or this shoulder is kind of going too high. I have to kind of adjust that, you know. You have to also think in the long term, you know, you want to have a good back when you get a little older and you want to have, you know, everything working how it's supposed to be, you know. And I think also one of the reasons why I started to try to find ways to play more relaxed, it was like, how can I play in a way that I can act, that I can still at a very old or late age can still play, you know, kind of relaxed and fast and, you know. So, yeah.
You know, I know what you mean. I had the great fortune once of taking one lesson from Changuito when he came here to Los Angeles. And this was like 5 or 6 years ago. But I remember him talking about, you know, motion and relaxation. And it wasn't very detailed of what he was saying, but I got it, you know. And, yeah, and he you know, would come over and slap your hand if it wasn't doing the right thing. But I know you have background with him, right?
Yeah. Well, not that much. I actually, the only teacher I had, actually, well, right before to study with Oscar Valdez, I took a lesson with a good friend of mine. His name is Alexei Marti. He used to live very close to where I live. He's a very good conguero player. They used to call him in Cuba El Tinta, because he's very, very dark. Like tinked. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you call it like that in but anyway, he's a very good friend. He lives in Louisiana now, I think. And also before that, I have this other friend of mine, which they call Modupue. He was singing at this band called Osain de Monte. And I think he's living in Spain now, but I'm not sure. That was my two first experiences before Oscar Valdez. These two guys, they show me like, okay, you should put the hand like this, you should put the hand like that. Let's go. We need to play now. You know, it was in a kind of party kind of situation, you know? But officially, the only teacher I have had is Oscar Valdez, the only one.
Okay.
And of course, in a way or another, of course, Tatawine, Anga, Changuito, Giovanni has also been my teachers.
Of course.
Because I used to watch, I used to check them a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially Giovanni at my very young age. And then later, I was like, let me dig a little bit more Tata and Changuito, because I kind of felt like there is some kind of root here that kind of, you know, because a lot of congueros and percussionists and musicians in general, they will always go to the icing, because, you know, some of your favorite players playing in a specific type of way, then you go straight to those who are your icons, but then you miss a little bit of the roots. So I was like, well, I love Giovanni, but let me go a little bit deeper. I went into check Tata and Changuito and El Niño very, very carefully. And after that, I was like, well, but Tata and Changuito and El Niño, where are they from? Where are they? Where is all this stuff coming from? So all that stuff come from the folkloric music. So I went into, okay, well, let me put all this aside and I will only go deep into folkloric stuff. And, you know, so Oscar Valdez, he helped me a lot with that. And I also did a lot of research on my own. You know?
You just said something I think really important for a lot of young players to hear. When you said going for the icing, you know, in today's world of finding so much material on YouTube and finding a video of somebody that you really love and you want to watch them play, and you're getting influenced by that, a lot of the time you are seeing that icing. You're seeing that thing that really turns you on and wants you to go work on that one thing or that cool thing you heard them do. And there's a lot of great young players now, but as far as how many of them actually go to the foundation of the instrument and find out where the root is of it, I mean, that's really important that you said that, because a couple of years ago, I attended a clinic with Ignacio Barora, and Ignacio does a great clinic about the roots of Cuban music, and I'm sure you know this. And it was very interesting, and it gave a lot of the history to the folkloric foundation and the African roots. And so, yeah, I mean, what you said, I think, is really important.
It is, and you know, once you get to know very well the tradition, you can actually you can actually play, you know, it's kind of like your foundation is rock solid, you know. You know, I think when I see people like, for instance, like there is many congueros these days I really like. And one of them is Pedrito Martinez, right?
Yes.
You know, Pedrito Martinez, he's coming from the folkloric music. And then he jumps into the popular music. For me, it was a little bit difficult somehow, because I was not from the folklore environment. And I was not from the school either. So I was kind of in the middle. So I studied with Oscar, which probably in his younger age, he was more into the folkloric scene, but he found out that the popular kind of way of playing was more like his thing. And also, instead of trying to just reproduce the traditional rhythms, maybe it was better to kind of find his own way to do things, you know? So I learned with him to kind of be able to transform things into my way. And that was actually very, very good. So, but I didn't have like that folklore of that time that I wanted to have. So I kind of had to go and dig into it. You know, I have to start going into the rumbas. I have to start going into the tambores. And I had to start to be curious in order to kind of go deep into that route I wanted to learn.
Thank you. You know, growing up in Cuba and, you know, as opposed to, you know, other countries that might not have the deep-rooted musical thing that happens in Cuba, it seems like there's music just all around you growing up there. And I think it also gives a foundation even to people that aren't necessarily following a musical path, but they're around the music all the time. You know, case in point, the natural feel of the clave, you know, and what you hear growing up. It seems like Cuba produces musicians that have a sense of time that's very, very, very strong. Do you agree?
I agree. Yeah, I think it's because of the folklore we have, you know, because of the folklore that is really alive, you know. You kind of, when I grew up, there was a lot of what they call tambores or fiestas, from the Yoruba religion or from the Congo religions or from the Abakwa religions. I live very close to a plante. A plante is where the Abakwas, they do their rituals, you know. So I could hear the clave all the way. I think it's about 1.5 kilometers from where I live. You can hear 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, 7 in the morning, the clave, ging, 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 you know. And then you are surrounded by people that practice the Yoruba religion and the Palo religion, and, you know, so you are surrounded by music, you know, and especially rhythm, because mm-hmm. most of those music expressions are rhythm and vocals, you know. So, yeah. I think that's why.
Right. Yeah. Now that you've been living abroad for a long time, you know, in Europe, what were the biggest challenges growing up in Cuba, trying to, you know, foresee your future, so to speak?
Oh, sorry, I didn't understand the question.
What were the bigger challenges for you in Cuba growing up and trying to learn music and develop your craft?
Well, it was not that difficult actually to learn music in Cuba. No, I wouldn't say that. I would say it was, you know, I had Oscar and that was such a important thing. I also was lucky enough that we have in Cuba a guy called Kono, Haruhiko Kono. Kono is a percussionist from Japan, and he have one of the biggest collections of music, you know, that you can imagine, you know. And Oscar told me, you know, hook up with Kono and let's try to see some videos of Giovanni, try to see some videos. He have everything. Through Kono, I got to see everything. Bata Kumbele, Giovanni, Anthony Carrillo, Mito Cardona. I saw all the giants. Candido Camero, rest in peace, the great master. Mongo Santa Maria. He had it all. So I was very lucky, I might say. It's not probably everybody that have the chance to see all those materials, you know, from the Funny All-Star, from the Tropic Jazz All-Stars. He had every single concert, everything that happened in New York, everything that happened in Puerto Rico, in Tokyo, in Havana. He still has it all. So, yeah, I am also very thankful for Kono, you know, and for the time he also dedicated to me and to, you know, to be able to see what happened in the world at that time. I remember the first time I saw Giovanni playing with Michel Camilo, they did a duo. I think it was a Tropic Jazz All-Star or something like that. They did that duo with the song called On Fire, you know. it was one of these moments that I said, wow, I want that. I want to play like that. I want to be able to do that, you know? And I remember when I met Michel the first time, Michel Camilo, I was like, you know, one of the things I will never remember when I was a kid is watching you and Giovanni playing On Fire live at the, I think it was Tropic Jazz All Star. I hope I'm not mistaken, but that was kind of like, wow, one of the highlights. I want to play like that. I want to try that experience, you know? Yeah.
What a great moment that you were able to, like, you know, see that when you were younger, and then actually be able to tell him in person when you're playing with him. That, I mean, yeah, that is such a beautiful thing. You know,
he's amazing, man.
Yeah,
he's,
yeah,
he is.
Michel Camilo is incredible. I saw him once in my life, and it was in New York with Dave Weckl playing drums, and it was in a club that's no longer there on the Upper West Side, but it was one of those moments, you know. It was, as you well know, I mean, such a virtuoso. And I, of course, watched him on video with you, and I hope to see that live one day. So when you left Cuba, what was the catalyst for leaving Cuba? Where did you go first?
Well, I think around 2004, I came here to Denmark the first time to work with the Danish Radio Big Band. And I was kind of like, already in Cuba, I was thinking like, wow, there was too many limitations. It was always some kind of trouble every time I had to travel abroad Cuba. No? Mm-hmm. So, but I was lucky enough again to have some good friends that helped me there while I was living in Cuba. And I was able to come and work here. So I would do like 3 months here in Europe, and then 2 or 3 months in Cuba, and then come back. And especially using Denmark as my base place, no? So the transition was actually slow. It was not like, okay, now I am staying here and that was it. No. Mm-hmm. It was quite slow. So I had a job and I had a house, and I already had a girlfriend. At the time, I took the decision, okay, well, maybe I need to be here a little bit more because of the work, the house, and the girlfriend. So
yeah.
So it was kind of like, it was not very difficult at the moment I took the decision, you know?
So Denmark,
actually, yeah.
Denmark was a good place to springboard to,
exactly.
To other places, yeah.
Exactly. From here, I got to work with Bob Minzer, with the BBC Big Band, with many, many different projects here in Europe, you know. So it was kind of like a very strategic place. And again, you know, I kind of found the love also here. So it was not very difficult.
It sounds like it was like, you know, just kind of fell into place. I mean, Denmark it seems it would be a very also supportive of the arts there, correct?
Definitely. Here there is still like a musician syndicate, a culture minister that actually help a lot musicians and artists in general, you know. Yeah, it's a very good system. Yeah.
What was the? How did you come to record your first album in Japan?
Actually, I didn't record it in Japan, but I released. It was released under a Japanese record label.
Ah, okay.
But that was the very very first which I recorded. In the Egrem Studios in Havana with a lot of great musicians. And released in Japan. Yeah.
Okay. And then you recorded also a second album in Cuba, right?
The second one I recorded also in Cuba. It was kind of like a together project together with the drummer called Jonas Johansson and a bass player called Yasser Pino. The project was called Blanco y Negro. We record that around 2005 in Havana. I was out with a Danish label called Stoned Records. And with the same Stoned Records, I did my kind of, it was another solo album, but my first here in Denver, it was called El Conguero. The Cuban Funk Machine, which also from Stone Records, and I've been working with Stone for a while now. I feel very, very happy about all the releases we have had. The last album I released with them is called Cuban Jazz Report. It's a band. We are four musicians. Raul Pineda on drums, Caramelo Maso on piano, Yasser Pino bass, and myself on percussion and vocals. Are the recordings. I also did actually a funk album because about, I don't know, let's say 7 years ago, I found out that in the 70s, Cuban music was extremely funky. So I got to hear Los Bamban with Changuito on drums. And Pupi playing kind of like an organ. And I was like, wow, I have to try this. Because at that point, I was trying to figure out what can I do here in Denmark. Because I am missing elements. I'm missing the Cuban guys to play Cuban music. And I play jazz, but I don't want to play swing jazz all the time. How can I find a way to blend things together? And then I found those recordings from the 70s with Los Bamban, and I was like, that's it. I can find an organ player that can really play the organ here. I can find good guitar players that can play that music here. And then I have a Cuban bass player, a Cuban drummer, and that's it. It was perfect.
Does that album have the word dance in the title?
Exactly. That's the one called Dance or Die.
That's when I listened to that record, I immediately thought of the 70s funk music.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Were you singing?
Yes, I was singing too. And I also feature a few friends of mine. Actually, I have two friends from Los Angeles that are featuring the album, Derrick Harris and DJ Unique, which I met at the dance. What was the name of the, in LA, they had this kind of dancing place, the floor Impro, I think it's called.
Okay.
I met him over there. So I am featuring these two rappers, rap and hip hop artist, and I'm also featuring a singer from the UK, Jordan Joseph. Yeah. And I mean, it was a nice experience doing that album, you know, and trying to mix things up and experimenting, you know.
You know, I recommend that. I recommend all of your records to everybody that's listening because they're all so unique and have so much depth. But that record too is just, it's really a fun, interesting side of you. And I think that, you know, everybody should check it out. You know, the Cuban Funk Machine, when this came out, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this when you right around when you played at NAMM with the band and you were playing in the courtyard, in the big courtyard at NAMM?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that was, I think it was the year before.
Okay.
The year before I played at NAMM. Because when I played at NAMM, I was already kind of, the first Cuban Funk Machine, it was kind of more into the Cuban side of the funk. And the second album, Dance or Die, is more the more funky side of the Cuban, you know?
Right.
Right before I played at NAMM, I was kind of in that kind of transition, you know,
right?
Of from the very Cuban to a little bit more funky, you know.
Right. Who were some of the American soul or R&B artists that were influencing you in Cuba? Were you getting that music down there?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So like Marvin Gaye or who? I mean, those kinds of artists? Or
I think Marvin Gaye is like an older generation.
Right.
You know, I'm from the 90s.
Right.
So if you say R&B, the R&B my generation was kind of consuming at that time, it would be something like Boyz II Men.
Uh-huh.
And there was this band called Casey and JoJo. And,
sure.
You know, some of those more 90, Maxwell, you know, I got to know Marvin Gaye and some of these older artists. I got to know them here in Denmark, because in Cuba, it was difficult to get information. So, for instance, this friend of mine, Kono, he would have a huge library of Latin music, but, you know, I was missing a lot of the other side of music, no?
Right.
I didn't get to know I didn't get to listen too much to Santana, or even though I got to listen a little bit to Santana. A friend of mine had a couple of CDs, but I got to hear a lot of music also here when I moved to Europe. Huh?
Right, 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 right.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your teaching, and how you look at working with your students and what you have them focus on when you first start working with them.
Well, I normally teach, I have been guest teacher in many conservatories around here and different places in Europe, Switzerland, Denmark, Sweden, et cetera, et cetera. It depends on the level of the student, but because some of the students are interested in technique, some of the students are interested in improvisation. So I kind of try to give them a little bit of the basics, a little bit of the folkloric part, and teach them how to blend things together, like folkloric with technique, both using doubles or single strokes. And we would normally start with that, but of course it all depends on what the students are looking for, especially because I am not doing I'm not a teacher, like a full-time teacher, you know. I am not into a program of teaching right now. So it's kind of like, it's different from time to time.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. When you get somebody that comes to you at first, or when you're going to a school and you're watching somebody play, do you find yourself, like, what after you see them, say, okay, there's some work that needs to be done in technique first before we move on so we can get a sound out of the drum? Or do you find, or if they already have that going, then you can move forward with something else, or?
Yeah, you know, for me, the sound is the most important. It's the, like, the identity card of every single musician, you know? That's how I see it. So I would always work in the sound, and then the technique of how to put the hands and also, you know, a part of the technique, a part of the sound is how to place your hands on the conga. So that's also part of the technique.
You know, that goes back to what we talked about earlier in the conversation in regards to your smooth, effortless style and fluidity. You know, when it comes to posture and sitting at the drum,
yep,
or if you're standing or sitting, let's talk a little bit about that as far as the height of the drum with where you're playing and how you approach that, to, as a, you know, because you know, if the drum isn't at the right height, or if you're not sitting in the right place, your shoulders can be up, it can be unrelaxed. So how do you approach that with your students?
I always try to, I always advise my students to kind of sit in a position where they are as relaxed as possible. In a position also where their arms have kind of like a little bit above 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. And a position where your shoulders are completely relaxed. And your elbows are also completely relaxed. In a way that you don't need to move your arms to the side, more use your arms up and down.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right.
That's kind of the procedure. I don't know how you would call it. That's kind of the way I will use. No.
Mm-hmm. Do you work with rudiments with them? Because I see you doing a lot of double strokes and different types of, you know, almost like snare drum rudiments, you know, when you're
yes.
playing.
Yeah, I normally would work with the thick controls.
Right.
From 4 to 7, especially number 5.
Right.
The number 7, I really, really, really like it. And I have found a lot of different combinations that I think are very useful for all the students kind of to try, you know? There is a lot of possibilities when you play on technique on congas also, you know? Mm-hmm. You can use the opens, the slabs, the bass tones. So it's kind of like, yeah, of course, stick controls and rudiments, paradiddles. Everything that drummers have studied is also useful today. Today is also useful on congas, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It's not. I think it's like when I play double, especially, I always think about stick technique. You know, you play one stroke with the wrist and the other one with the fingers when you bounce back, you know, 1-2, 1-2. So I always work on that on students, like, okay, one stroke with the arm and the other one with the wrist. So you have kind of like the same type of technique of a drummers, you know, mm-hmm. or similar. You can actually get to play quite fast, as mm-hmm. fast as drummers too, you know, when you use the technique right. Yeah.
When you were starting out, though, I mean, you were watching the players that you loved watching, you know, playing congas. But what about the influence of watching bata players and bata ensemble and that?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. I also had. For me, it was important to listen to it because of the language of the drum.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't necessarily need to play the same rhythms. You don't necessarily need to play the same, but you need the language.
Right.
That Yoruba language of the drums. I never learned. I did learn a little bit of bata drums, bata drumming, but I never took it very deep. But I did listen a lot to it in order to get the language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, it depends on what I'm playing. It always comes up,
right?
So one way or another, yeah.
Because isn't the conversation between the three bata drums, and correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of a spearhead to how conversation is between conga players when there's a, you know, in folkloric music, there's a part on each drum and they're conversing and exchanging and.
Yeah. The relation is similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar. It's the same concept, I would say, but in another level.
Right.
When it comes to bata drums, is in a completely different level, because the singer kind of will dictate where the rhythm goes. You know, sometimes you don't have the singer, then you have the ija, the el mayor, the tambor mayor.
Mm-hmm.
He also kind of changes around the rhythms, right? So it's a little bit different. It's not like in rumba. It's not like in abacua. It's not like in bembe. It's a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, you know, I actually find so amazing that that Cubans or Africans or slaves got to develop such a complex thing, like all these bata drums, all these bata drumming rhythms. It's like they were allowed to play one time a week. How did they do it? You know, I guess it was many years of playing. Probably they were thinking about it all the time, or, you know, I find it complex. Sometimes I get lost also when I hear it, you know. Yeah.
And it's also steeped in religion, correct?
Yes, it's very, very, very deep in religion. And I don't, you know, that's also one of the things why I probably didn't took it too deeper, because at the time I was in Cuba, it was kind of, and I think still today, if you want to go deep into bata drumming, many times you kind of need to also go a little bit more into the religion, you know? And well, I have other types of beliefs, and I didn't really get too much into it. But from the outside, I was listening a lot to it, and also learning a little bit with some of my friends, and mm-hmm. you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Ayo, ayo.
Hey, 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 hey.
Talk a little bit about your choice of instruments, and specifically gombops, and how you were introduced to the brand. Was it from Raul Pineda?
Well, the first person that talked to me about gombops was Raul Rico.
Okay.
While he was living here in Denmark, I don't know if you know, but he was married here in Denmark, and he said to me, "Hey man, you know, because I don't know why, but we start talking about gombos. I think it was because we saw this old school conga from Cuba that was called Vergara, and he said to me, "Hey man, you know, but in California where I live, they have these gombops you have to check out." And then I remember the first time I was about to travel to the States to participate in NAMM, I talked to Raul Pineda. And he said to me, "Hey man, you know, I am a," at that time, I think Raul was a gombops artist.
Right.
And he said to me, "Hey, you know, I can talk to Rich." And I remember because One of the things I like about Gumbops, especially the Mariano series, is that it reminds me so much of the Cuban old rumberos, you know?
Right.
And I didn't see a conga that was more close to those days that the Mariano series, especially the Mariano series you have right now with the chrome hardware, right?
Yeah, which you inspired us to go that direction.
Exactly. Thank you. And you know, it was kind of like, well, I have to try to approach Gumbops and see if we can work together, because, you know, it's kind of like there is nothing better than to play an instrument that kind of really represents who you are. And I really feel that when I play Gumbops, you know, mm-hmm. this,
yeah.
especially the Mariano series.
I'm always very thankful to Raul when he told me about you, because he was the one that called me, and we're always very thankful to him for introducing us to you.
And I am very thankful also to him for letting me know about you and about Gumbos. It's been a blessing for me, honestly. Mm-hmm. I feel like me and Gumbos kind of like are basically one now, you know. It's like I think our relation and having you as an artist manager, you know, it's been a blessing. Honestly, I am so thankful. To you and to Luis, and in, you know, you've been like very, very good brothers, you know, good partners, and I have no complaints, and I'm very happy and fortunate to play Gumbos percussion.
Well, we are too. Let's talk. I wanted to go back to you use the Marianos predominantly, but let's talk a little bit about when you go between using synthetic versus natural hide heads and how you, you know, you have to have the option because of different gigs you're doing or climates. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mostly use in them when I play here when I play festivals I think lately I am playing 60-70%, a little bit more synthetics. And the reason is the weather. Mm-hmm. You know, the weather here is so bad. Sometimes it's better than other times, but I have suffered a lot playing with cowskins here in Denmark, you know, especially outdoors.
Right.
So I kind of took the decision I will play a little bit more synthetics and try to find a way to make the synthetic sound a little bit more natural.
Mm-hmm.
I figure out that sometimes when you tune it in some ways, or when you kind of tune it very, very hard, high at the beginning of when it's a new skin, for instance, when you tune it very, very, very high and leave it there for a little while, then you turn it a little bit down, kind of the skin gets a little bit more, it's kind of like, it gets a little bit more, that, you know, it loses a little bit of the overtones somehow.
Yeah.
I also found out that the most I use those skins, the better they start to sound. I don't know if it's the grease from the hands. I don't know exactly what it is, but yeah, I love playing synthetics at the moment. And I also love playing raw heads. I actually do use a lot of real skins or cow skins.
Yeah.
Especially in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
I do use them a lot.
Right.
But I mean, it's very difficult to say which one I prefer the most.
Right. Of course, they're different applications.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And timbales?
Yeah. Oh, timbales, Alex Acuña.
Mm-hmm.
Timbales is my favorite, I might say. It's a very, very good timbales. Very well designed. Very good stand. It's like rock solid. I love it. I really love the, but I love all of them. Love all of them. I also love the Oreste Vilato, which I also have, and the Luisito Quintero one, which I also have tried. Actually, once I was once on tour with the Richard Bonner, and in one of the tours, I got to play the Luisito Quintero timbales. Wow. Amazing sound. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, the cascara is different between the two, the brass and the steel, of course. So it gives you a different range of what you might.
Exactly. I am, when it comes to cascara, I am more for the steel than for the brass.
Right.
But both of them are very, very good timbales, definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's happening lately with you? And I mean, given all of the restrictions that we're all living in right now, are you working on original music? Are you doing remote recording? What's happening right now?
Well, I just finished recording a trio album. And at the time I was starting to record a new album, because I'm kind of using this time to just record material and have some material for the future, no? But at the time I was starting to record my Rumba album, the lockdown came. So now it's kind of like, well, I will have to wait until next year. But I am trying to keep myself busy with music, composition, and studying, also teaching through Skype, and I don't do it a lot, but I find the spots to do it when I have the time. I try to keep I try to be productive in these times. Yeah.
Do you have a studio there, or do you have access to a studio that you?
I do have a studio here, where I do most of my recordings. It's a film school where I am allowed to use the facilities. And
great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do they run Pro Tools, or they run? What do they run for their?
I got my own gear over there, and I use Logic for my recordings.
Yeah, I do as well.
It was the first DAW I tried. Is it DAW, how you call it?
Yeah, DAW. Yeah. It's pretty user-friendly.
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of like, well, and you know, when you use Logic, a lot of the stuff is already there. You don't need to buy too much stuff extra. So it was kind of easy, a good start. And since then,
Yeah. Are you hearing from artists that you've worked with, you know, more on the regular basis, like Michelle or whoever, as far as any kind of forecast for 2021, maybe summer on, as far as are they starting to look at, like, well, it's, I mean, I know it's hard to plan, but.
Well, you know, here in Europe, I'm not sure how it is in the States, but here in Europe, they kind of opened and they were doing a lot of concerts during the summer. And also in the fall, right before they locked again, you know, there was a lot of activities and a lot of things going on. So I do have already a date with Michelle in Switzerland in May, as far as I remember. Oh, I don't know if I'm supposed to say it now that I say it, but I think it's about to be official at some point. Anyways. But I think things are starting to happen. So I expect that next year things are going back to as close as possible to normal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am not sure that it's going to go back to completely normal. But hopefully it will at least go as close as possible to normal.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, we all kind of hope the same thing, but it's different in every place that you know, we hear about. For example, hearing about Australia and New Zealand and how well they're doing right now, you know, with this. And they seem to be ahead of everywhere else. But, Yeah, I remember seeing images and videos of performances going on in Europe in the summertime, and I see these clips all the time from Yasmani Santos too in Africa, and him doing a lot of outdoor gigs. I guess it just depends on the region and that stuff. Do you kind of have someone that you've never worked with before that you would love to work with someday?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, because I have, I would love to work with so many musicians, you know. But if I could mention one, that's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It's very difficult. There is one musician I really, really, really like and I have listened a lot to. And that's Joy DeFrancesco. He's one of my favorite all-time Hammond players.
Yeah.
I think it's just amazing.
Yeah, I love him.
It's just incredible.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, someone like, I don't know, I really like George Benson. I grew up listening to George Benson.
Well, you know, speaking of people we'd like to work with, I want to ask you about working with Wayne Shorter, because he's one of my, you know, one of my all-time heroes, you know. And you did work with him, and I'm curious how that experience was.
Well, you know, I played with Wayne in Tokyo. It was kind of like, let's call it an all-star that Herbie Hancock put together for the ending of the night of the Tokyo Jazz Festival.
Right.
So I don't know if I could say I have worked with him like that, but I was on stage with him and we played together.
And Herbie.
So that's true. And with Herbie.
Yeah.
And with Brian Blade. Ooh. And Deanna Reeves and many other great musicians. Iromi Uehara, I think is her name also. Yeah, I mean, it was a very, 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 very good, wonderful experience. I might call it one of the highlights of my career, huh?
Right.
To be on stage with all these giants. Oh, and Dave Holland on bass. I mean, it's like, those were giants of jazz giants, you know? It doesn't get better than that.
Yeah. I'm just curious about your view on staying in shape and how it affects what we do as drummers. And tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do to do that and to stay in shape, and how it affects, you know, your ability to, you know, have endurance and relaxation and all of that.
Well, I feel like, my feeling is that sports is actually good for any type of other, you know, whether if whether you are a musician or you are a architect or whatever, you know, sports is a very important thing for our health, you know, and eating too, mm-hmm. eating the right stuff, exercising, also meditation. I found it very, very, very good for my playing. Mm-hmm. You know? I once was with this friend of mine, Darryl Jones, and he was telling me when he was playing with Miles was cooking a very nice fish. He was a good cook. And everybody was like, wow, Miles, we didn't know you can cook like this. And he was like, you know, everything works together. You know, one art help the other art.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of like I took that very serious. Okay, well, you know, I will take my sports art, try to put it in the highest level I can. And I have the feeling that this can also help my other art, my main art, which is music, you know? Conga drumming is such a physical thing, you know? Even though I try to use as much less muscles when I play, you know? But still, it's a physical act, you know, to play music. You need to kind of be in shape for for an hour or 2 hours of playing, you know? Sometimes when I play Latin jazz, fast Latin jazz, you need to be in shape for that. So yeah, it's definitely a must-do thing to kind of be in shape,
yeah.
You know, by doing exercises and sports. And food is also a very important thing, you know? Food is important thing. I actually, it's been like 2 years since I kind of became plant-based.
Okay.
And it's been a very good thing for me. It's been a very, very, very good. The change is enormous, I might say.
Okay.
I can feel it in my body and I can see it in my health, you know. I used to drink pills and stuff like that. And, you know, I am out of all that stuff, you know, completely clean.
Do you find it difficult to be plant-based and travel?
A little bit. But, you know, since I start in this kind of, let's call it a journey, I also figured out that I was eating too many times a day. And, you know, I think we have kind of been a little bit misled to like, oh, you need to eat every 3 hours, or you need to eat 3-4 times a day, and you need to have a snack here. And you know, it's kind of like now I am more like, I do some long times without eating, kind of like intermittent fasting. And, you know, sometimes when I travel, I take a pause. If I see that, you know, the food of my desire is not there, I will wait. I'm not gonna die for waiting 12 hours without eating. I know that, you know, later I might go to a market and get the stuff I need, you know, or to a restaurant, you know. But I have a different kind of point of view about food these days, you know. So it can be challenging, definitely.
Yeah.
It can be. It's kind of like, hey, Elia, come and eat with us this day. Oh, man, okay, no problem. Hey, man, you know, is it possible to to do something a little bit different? You know, it's kind of like that these days, you know.
You have to be a little flexibility a little bit, you know.
Exactly. Hey, Elia, let's go and eat to this restaurant. Hey, man, yeah, no problem. Hey, do you know if they have a menu like this or like that? You know, is it flexible, you know? Yeah, it's a little different, definitely.
Yeah.
But I had to do it for my health, you know?
Yeah, of course.
That's how it is.
As far as, you know, staying in the same topic of staying in shape, and Let's talk about your hands. I mean, being a physical art form, playing congas, and do you find certain things that what I'm trying to say is, the way I've seen you play, it seems like your economy and the way you approach playing the drum saves your hands. If somebody plays incorrectly, they could have a lot of pain or problems. Talk a little bit about hand health, I guess, when it comes to playing such a physical drum.
Well, I think one of the most important thing when it comes to the hands is the position.
Right.
If you use the right position while you play the drums, that will save you a lot of hands, like, let's say like that, right? But again, there is not like a, like an exact science about it, because, you know, when I see the rumberos and people that play folkloric music, you know, they hit it hard, man. They hit it so hard. They have like rock. Their hands are like rock.
Yeah.
Right. And they're still, you know, they can still play, you know, a whole night and a whole week and a whole month if it's necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not exact science about it, but in my case, I always try to save my hands, you know, always try to find the right position, the right dynamics, so that I can kind of like go to fifth and sixth gear when I need it, and then go back to third and stay around there, you know.
Yeah, like what you said earlier about position of the hands and your in your shoulders and your elbows and everything, and how the, you know, how you hit the drum. Yeah, it has a lot to do with the economy and how you, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these days are different days. In the old days, when you listen to a band like Irakere, you can see that El Niño is playing super hard. He's putting all the power in it, you know. But these days, you know, you have more references, you have more microphones, you have, you know, it's different days. You don't need to play as hard as you used to play in those days, you know. So mm-hmm. I could just say, you know, to everyone, you know, stay healthy, stay in shape, eat the right stuff, especially in these days, in these times, you know, and be patient, practice, and enjoy every good time, you know, enjoy every second, and we hope the better times will come.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Amen to that. Thank you very much for joining us today, Eliel.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and really look forward to once this all passes, get to see each other again and be together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like in the good old days.
Exactly. In our good old days. And it's going to happen again.
Definitely.
Take very good care.
Take care, my friend. Thank you.
Stay tuned for more upcoming episodes very soon here in the Percussion Loft. And we thank our wonderful guest today, Eliel Lazo. And we will be in touch very soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.